This is Talk of the Nation. I'm John Idsty, sitting in for Neil Conan. Today in Iraq, an estimated 1 million Shiite Muslims participated in a spectacle unrivaled in decades, the traditional pilgrimage to the holy cities Najaf and Karbala, to honor the son-in-law and grandson of the Prophet Muhammad. The pilgrimage, which was banned under Saddam Hussein, was largely peaceful, but in Karbala, thousands demonstrated against the United States. Since the fall of Saddam Hussein's regime, there's been an outpouring of religious feeling and anti-American sentiment among Iraqi Shiites. The Shiites, who were brutally repressed by Saddam Hussein, make up 60% of Iraq's population. There are concerns a Shiite-dominated government might persecute the minority Sunni Muslims who have controlled power in Iraq since the nation was formed after World War I, not to mention potential persecution of the Kurdish minority in northern Iraq. Has the U.S. miscalculated the Shiites' power? What is Shiism, and how does it differ from Sunniism? Can the Shiites, Sunnis, and Kurds share power peacefully? How can the U.S. best encourage that outcome? The Shiites of Iraq is our topic this hour. Join the conversation. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. Joining us now from her office in Washington is Dana Priest, national security reporter for The Washington Post. In today's paper, she writes that the U.S. government was taken by surprise at how strong and unified Shiite anti-American reaction has been. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Where did the Shiites fit into the equation of war and its aftermath as the U.S. planned for this toppling of the regime in Iraq?
Well, it appears they fit in minimally, and this is rather stunning given the fact that this is no surprise to anybody who's looked at Iraq for many years. There are many outside experts on Iraq who would tell you about the Shiite community, who could explain the various different tracks, but also the very much powerful faction that was waiting for this day in Iran, mm-hmm. and has been agitating for it underground, and now is taking its what it sees as its rightful place in politics in Iraq now. Likewise, with many reports that we will never see, those from the intelligence community, both at DOD, from the Defense Intelligence Agency, and the CIA, who've also looked at this for many years. And this, in fact, was one of the reasons that President Bush I did not go ahead, unseat Saddam Hussein, was that this fear of a vacuum being created, and how would you handle that? Well, what we were told in reporting our story was that those views were again expressed by the various government agencies, but the people who analyzed them were not sure how far up the chain they were passed, and certainly it doesn't look like they were incorporated into any plan by the senior members of the administration who have been so headstrong about the war in Iraq.
Mm-hmm. Was it partly this Pentagon State Department split that we've heard a lot about in the administration?
I think that was definitely part of it, but it's not the only part. And I do think it goes also into ideology to a certain degree, if you could make it that simple, that General Secretary of State Powell was able to predict a more chaotic end to the war in Iraq, where Donald Rumsfeld and Paul Wolfowitz, his deputy, and their ideological brethren, if you will, on the Defense Policy Board, I'm thinking of Richard Perle, share the view that democracy is a very attractive notion, not just for Americans, but for people throughout the world. And if they have a chance to grab it, they will.
Mm-hmm.
And I just don't think that is a universally shared belief within the U.S. government, but that is a dominant, or that's a belief among those who are able to dominate the discussion about Iraq.
As you said, the first Bush administration did not topple Saddam Hussein, partly because it was concerned about Iranian influence on Shiites in Iraq. And today, the U.S. warned Iran not to interfere with Iraqi Shiites. Where do the Iranian Shiites fit into this?
Well, there are Iraqis who've been living in Iran and who share the same strain of Islam and some of the same clerics and have been exiled or living in exile in Iran, waiting for this day. And so now what you see is some of those people have gone back. We've heard of the Badr Brigades.
Mm-hmm.
Those have been funded financially but also trained by Iran. And now you even have some clerics who were involved with a group called Skiri, also in Iran, come back into Iraq and anoint themselves clerics in particular towns. So you know that the clerics in Iran are very well organized, and that Iran in general has a discipline among its military that the U.S. can identify, and they have shared that with the Iraqis who believe in their version of Islam. So they are a very strong, organized group, as opposed to other Shiite in Iraq who perhaps, certainly under Saddam Hussein, were not allowed to organize.
Mm-hmm.
So that gives the Iranian side a slight edge, if you will, on just pure organization.
Mm-hmm.
I think on the ground today we have some reports of that playing out in Kut, where the U.S. military has tried to unseat an Iranian-backed cleric and has had no luck so far.
Mm-hmm. There are, in fact, at least three factions that we know of, three families of clerics that may end up, getting a leadership role. There's a family named Al-Hakim, another family Al-Sadr, another family Al-Kowi, each of whom has a sort of a different approach to what a government ought to be in Iraq.
Right. And the fact, again, to go back to the gist of the surprise in the U.S., I mean, Iraq experts could point to those families with no problem and to talk about their competition with one another and their possible popular support within even the repressed communities that were living under Saddam Hussein. So, again, to think that they had not had a way to deal with this is pretty remarkable. And then, as one of my colleagues was saying just a little while ago, well, how would you deal with it?
Mm-hmm.
And that's a great question, because unlike the Balkans, Bosnia and Kosovo, where we have another example of a peacekeeping operation in the midst of great tension and turmoil between the populations in Kosovo being Serbs and Albanians, the military could impose a presence, but that was largely because it was a small area. Here you're talking about a very large country, so you would have to, if you wanted to suppress some of this, you would have to at least have a much, much bigger American military presence, and that's perhaps what General Shinseki, the head of the Army, was thinking when he said to Congress that it would take a couple hundred thousand troops to actually pacify Iraq.
Mm-hmm. And where does this leave U.S. plans for a secular government as opposed to an Islamic government in Iraq?
Well, I think they're going to be trying to compete with the Islamic government adherence at the same time that they're trying to do all other things, such as stand up electricity, make sure that their person, who appears to be Ahmad Shalabi, the exile, who is a Shiite himself but is secular, try to protect him and his base, which is coming under a lot of attack and certainly not very much support from the religious Shiite community. So it's going to be having to do many of these things all at once. And meanwhile, to try to stave off, and I'm not sure it really has the ability to do that. It is such a large country. We don't have that much, as the CIA would say, penetration in the country. We haven't had a very good intelligence relationship with Iraq for obvious reasons, or with Iran, because of the nature of our relations with that country. So we can't really totally predict what Iran is up to either.
All right. Thanks for your time.
All right. My pleasure. Thank you.
Dana Priest joined us from her office at the Washington Post. Now with us is Itzhak Nakash. He's a professor of Middle East history at Brandeis University and the author of The Shias of Iraq. He joins us by phone from his home in Princeton, New Jersey. Professor, welcome to the program.
Good afternoon. Pleased to join you.
First, let's clarify our terms here. We've heard this group described as Shia, the Shiites, And as in the title of your book, Shias, are these all proper terms for describing this religious group?
Yes, they are. They are basically stylistic variations. Shiites, Shia, They're all legitimate.
And how many Iraqis identify themselves as Shiites?
Well, we don't have accurate, of course, figures, but the estimate is that Shiites or Shiis are about 60% of the population in Iraq.
So about a majority of the population in Iraq, but a minority among Muslims worldwide.
That's right.
Relatively small minority.
A minority of about 11 to 15%.
Mm-hmm. Tell us, describe the events that precipitated the religious split between Shiites and Sunnis, and then we'll talk a little bit about how that's manifested in current religious practice.
Yeah, as you mentioned, Islam embraces two principal branches, Sunnism, which is the majority faith, and Shiism. Now, the split within the Muslim community between Sunnis and Shiis can be traced to 632. That's the year the Prophet Muhammad died. The Prophet did not appoint a successor. After his death, a majority of Muslims rallied around Abu Bakr, whom they recognized as caliph. But there was another group of Muslims who advocated that Ali ibn Abi Talib, the Prophet's son-in-law and cousin, deserved to be the successor. Members of this group became known as the followers of Ali, or Shi'at Ali. And over a period of 14 centuries, what was initially a political dispute within the Muslim community has assumed sociocultural dimension that occasionally manifested themselves in sectarian strife.
Mm-hmm. And we've seen some very dramatic pictures of the Shiite religious pilgrims in Karbala over the past few days. They're also, I believe, in Najaf. Can you tell us a bit about what's going on there? As I understand it, they've come to pay homage to Ali, son-in-law of the Prophet?
Yesterday, they came to pay homage to the second son of Ali, Hussein. Shiites make several visitations every year to the shrines of their imams. This particular visitation to the shrine of Imam Hussein in Karbala, known as Ziyarat al-Arba'in, marks the 40th day after the Battle of Karbala in the year 680, when Hussein, second son of Ali, died at the hand of his Umayyad enemies. Now, historically, this occasion was intended to bring together Shiites from all over Iraq to Karbala. This occasion served to boost Karbala's status among the Shiites. This visitation also provided opportunities for Shiites to protest against the government, which explains why the Ba'ath regime banned this visitation since 1977. Now, I should say, it is not surprising to see Shiite demonstrations during the visitation today when various groups are competing for political power and influence in the post-Saddam Iraq. And all this is, of course, happening amidst a power vacuum in the country.
Mm-hmm.
It is also not surprising to see demonstrators chanting slogans for an Iraq free from foreign rule. This was the case during the British mandatory period in Iraq, and it will be the case as long as U.S. troops remain in Iraq. It is a reality we have to accept and work with.
Mm-hmm. Very quickly, is there a difference between religious practice among Sunnis and Shiites?
The major differences have to do with some interpretations of the law, as well as rituals. Shia Islam is richer than Sunni Islam in its rituals. The example of the visitation that takes place this week shows the more colorful tone of Shia Islam in relation to Sunni Islam.
We'll talk more about that when we come back. We're talking about Shia in Iraq with the collapse of Saddam Hussein's regime. How will this formerly oppressed community approach government? We're taking your calls at 800-989-TALK. I'm John Itzty. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. We're talking about the Shiites in Iraq. With us is Itzhak Nakash. He's a professor of Middle East history at Brandeis University, and we're taking your calls as well. And we have a caller from Boulder, Colorado. Hala, you're on the air. Do you have a question or comment, please?
Yes, I have two. Can you hear me?
Yes, indeed.
Yes, I have two questions. The first is, It was my belief that in Islam, in the Quran, it specifically says that Islam should not be split into sects. And how would any devout Muslim justify the fact that it has indeed split into the Sunni and Shiite sect? And the second prong of the question is, wouldn't official U.S. support of the democratically elected moderate president of Iran help stabilize and create a political atmosphere in Iraq to get a secular democracy set up?
Professor Nakash, do you have a response to those questions?
Yeah, regarding the first question, there's always a tension within Islam, and indeed within every religion, between the scripture and the reality on the ground. Although the Quran instructs Muslims to remain unified, it is conditions in daily life that determine the degree to which Muslims are unified, and it is indeed that reality that explains the divisions within the Muslim community. Concerning the second question, the issue of U.S. interference in Iranian politics is a very delicate one. One can make an argument that the U.S. Support of the moderates in Iran would help the moderates, but you can also make an argument that the U.S. interference in Iranian politics can backfire. It is a very delicate issue, and I can understand why the U.S. is acting very, very carefully.
Thank you, Hala.
Thanks.
Thank you, Professor. Let's go to Lakshmi in, I believe, Novi, Michigan. Lakshmi, you're on the line.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah, the question I had was more to do with politics. One notices that the Sadr faction in Baghdad city is very powerful with the Shiites there, who all seem to be somewhat of poorer social background. And it is noticed that they're also extremist, and a recent assassination of a rival Shiite cleric was also laid at their door. Now, how does the U.S. military administration, which is on the ground, deal with the Sadr faction, which bids fair to be a faction supporting militant Islam?
Mm-hmm. Professor, tell us who the Sadr faction is, first of all.
Yeah, I obviously can't tell you how the U.S. military is dealing with the various groups, but the Sadr family is a very prominent family within Shia Islam in Iraq. It is an Arab family. It produced a number of very senior clerics during the 20th century. Two of the most senior clerics that emerged from this family were executed or gunned down by the Ba'ath regime. What we have actually witnessed in the past couple of weeks is a struggle for power within Shia religious circles, with various families trying to assert themselves to gain influence within the shrine cities and within Shia religious circles. The Sadr family is one. Hakim family is another. The Khoi family, which you mentioned, is a third family. And above all these families stand the Grand Ayatollah, Ali Sistani, the most revered and senior cleric, who is based in Najaf.
Mm-hmm. Can you give us a thumbnail sketch of the politics or the approach that each one of these factions might take?
Well, I guess we should start with Ali Sistani, who is known as the Marja al-Taqlid, or the most senior source of emulation in Shia Islam. Ali Sistani is a student of the late Marja Abu al-Qasim al-Khoi, who died in 1992. Ali Sistani is a follower of a school of thought within Shia Islam that traditionally has pursued a quietist approach, that traditionally accepted the notion that Shia clerics should focus on spiritual affairs and leave politics to the politicians. This explains why Ali Sistani in the past few days advised his followers not to push the Marja'iyah, or the Shia leadership, to interfere in politics, and he indeed advised Iraqis that they should form a government that is suitable to them. But Ali Sistani, which may be regarded as the first or the highest tier within the Shiite clerical establishment, is only one voice. Beneath this tier, there are lower tiers. You have sons of grand ayatollahs, like Muqtada Sadr. We have the late Abdulmajid al-Khoi, and we have Muhammad Bakr al-Hakim. These are all sons of great ayatollahs. They are vying for leadership. Some of them actually believe that they should not pursue a quietist approach, but an activist approach. Mm-hmm. The Sadr family represents perhaps in the most clearest terms this adherence to the notion that clerics should be involved in politics.
And probably would back an Islamic government in Iraq?
I think that the Sadr family would back an Islamic government in Iraq.
Let's go to an email now from Niels in Denver, Colorado. Niels writes, is the difference between Shiites and Sunnis comparable to any difference in Christianity? Is it like the difference between conservative Baptists or Southern Baptists, Baptists and Lutherans, Baptists and Catholics, or Baptists and Mormons?
To a degree, yes, but we have to look at the distinct characteristics. And again, when we talk about Sunnis and Shiis, we have to also look at the particular setting or the particular countries that we are discussing. In the case of Iraq, the interesting thing to note and to mention is that, like the Sunnis, the Shiites are predominantly Arabs. The difference between Sunnis and Shiites in Iraq is not cultural, it's not ethnic, it's political. In some other areas, the differences can be ethnic, but not in Iraq.
Mm-hmm. Professor Nakash, please stay with us, but we're going to bring in another guest. Joining us is Gary Sick, the acting director of Columbia University's Middle East Institute, and he's the author of All Fall Down, America's Tragic Encounter with Iran. He's with us by phone from his home in New York. Welcome, Professor Sick.
Delighted to be with you.
How do you think America's experience during the Iranian Revolution is affecting the administration's views about a future Iraqi government, if it's affecting it at all?
I'm not sure that the people who are involved in the policymaking have thought a great deal about the Iranian Revolution. There are a great many similarities, however, and a number of people have begun to point out the similarities between what happened in Iran. Specifically, I'm thinking about the sort of spontaneous outburst of political activity and political organization that emerges even in a country like Iraq, where they have been terrorized for years. You realize that beneath that sort of placid terrorist surface, there is actual politics going on, or at least it's there, ready to jump out. And we have seen groups, many of them Shia, suddenly forming themselves into organizations in neighborhoods, in towns, asserting control of areas, providing services to the people when the government collapsed, and so forth. And a lot of this, although I think the U.S. government is starting to leak reports that this was all Iranian-organized, or that somehow this organization was an Iranian thing, the reality is the same thing happened in Iran, in little neighborhoods where there was no organization at all and no outside influence. The reality is people there are ready to organize themselves, and we're seeing, honest-to-goodness, democracy at work. Mm-hmm. So where that goes from here is another question.
We've certainly heard concern from the administration today about interference by Iranians with Shiites in Iraq. On the other hand, there's been some talk that a growth of power among Shiites in Iraq might counterbalance the Islamic government in Iran. Do you think that's a possibility?
Well, you know, the group, the Supreme Council for the Islamic Revolution in Iraq, which the Siri group, which is Bakr al-Hakim, that has been living in Tehran for many years. Everybody, first of all, that group has always proclaimed while it was in exile that it represented, it was the voice of the Shia in Iraq, that who couldn't speak for themselves. That may have been true when that was happening, but it is no longer true once they have, once the government has fallen. All of a sudden, that group now faces real competition within the Shia community and within the population as a whole for who is in fact going to speak for the Shia. And they are struggling to try to assert themselves. And I think that is the reality that we are seeing. It isn't so much that the Shia have risen up as a whole, but that different Shia groups are competing for power and are asserting themselves in a real expression of democratic organization, which could turn very bad, actually, or it could, in fact, potentially be used.
Mm-hmm. Professor Nakash, what do you think? Will the sort of the freeing of the Iraqi Shiites change the balance of power among Shia around the world?
Yeah. You know, John, I'm a historian, and I like to measure developments and processes with years, by years, and not weeks and days. Let me say this. We hear a lot of talk about the possibility of the revival of the Shia Academic Center in Najaf. And that revival is possible. But if we are going to witness a revival of the Shia Academic Center in Najaf, we should come to terms with the fact that such a revival will increase contact between Iraqi Shiites and Iranians. But such a revival will also reinforce the distinct identity of Arab Shiism and generate healthy competition between Najaf and Qom in Iran over the leadership of the Shia world. But let me say this. The revival of the Shia Academic Center in Najaf will take years to mature. The process cannot be accomplished overnight, and it cannot be rushed.
Let's go to a caller again in San Diego. Farouk, you're on the air.
I'm sorry, did you say Farouk?
Yes.
Well, thank you very much. First thing, I would like to compliment Dr. Nakash, Professor Nakash, on his book. It's outstanding. It is beautifully done, very well written, and it really gets to the heart of the problem. The concern I have is this. This business of so many percent of people of Shia with so many Sunni, there had been such an incredible amount of intermarriage among these people. In my own family, I have five nieces. I grew up as a Sunni Muslim. In my family, I have five nieces who's married to Shiite. Then the issue of the Arabs and the Kurds. My brother who lives in Maryland is 100% Arab married to a 100% Kurdish woman. I grew up with seven friends. From fifth grade, two were Turkoman Sunnis, I was a Sunni, three Shiite, and we have another friend who is also a Christian as part of the group. This emphasis on the Shia and the Sunni and the Christian and the Kurds, which is being portrayed continuously as a major differences among these different groups, is very damaging, and it's really not conducive to any possibility of creating an environment in Iraq that is of democratic nature. And I would like to get some response from your guest.
Okay. Thank you, Farouk. Let me just say before we get that answer that you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. What do you think, Gary Sick? Is there too much being made of the potential differences there, and is there a greater pluralism in Iraqi society than we have come to expect?
I had a series of meetings with Iraqis, all expatriate Iraqis, over the past several years. And we always ask that question. I mean, to what extent is Iraq about to fall apart? If you took away the strongman leadership, the tyrant, would it simply break up into sectarian groups? And I must say that with every Iraqi that I've spoken with, the answer was no, that basically Iraq has become much more of a nation. They spoke very much of what the gentleman Farouk mentioned, that in Baghdad, which is considered the Sunni center of Iraq, is actually a Shia city. There are more Shia there than there are Sunnis. And Kurds live there also. And that over the years, these groups have intermingled. I don't think that's grounds for being sort of Pollyannish and saying, you know, there's not going to be any problem. I think there is going to be a problem. But I do believe that what we have seen in Farouk's case, but perhaps in other cases in Iraq and other countries as well, is that it is in fact possible for these groups to live together. And I personally think that any kind of a solution, a political solution in Iraq, which tries to govern or rule by sectarian divisions, by basically picking one group and say it's going to rule the other, is going to be a serious mistake that will in fact result in tremendous problems later on.
Would you agree with that, Dr. Nakash, that the prospects are good for all of these groups to work together and live in peace?
I think that the caller raised an excellent point, and I'd like to elaborate on that. There is a large proportion of mixed marriages in Iraq between Sunnis and Shiis. And as I said, Sunnis and Shiis are predominantly Arabs, and that's a very good starting point for Iraqis as they try to sort out their politics in a new state. As I mentioned, the tension between Sunnis and Shiites is not cultural or ethnic. It is political. It reflects the competition of the two groups over the right to rule and to define the meaning of nationalism in Iraq. Now, until the collapse of the Ba'ath regime, the ruling Sunni elite preferred Pan-Arabism as its main nationalist ideology. The Shiite majority has felt more comfortable with Iraqi nationalism, which stresses the values and traditions of Iraqi society. One of the big questions concerning the reconstruction of Iraq would be whether Iraqi nationalism or a sense of Iraqiness would be the dominant ideology, if you want to call it, in the new state. If the majority of Arabs, 75%, Sunnis and Shiites, can agree on a sense of Iraqiness, that would be an excellent starting point.
Mm-hmm. Let's try to take one quick call before our break. This is Steve in Portland, Oregon. Steve.
Yeah, I had a quick question about the cultural influence there. Is the liberated Iraq going to be tolerant, and is Shiite more tolerant of free expression with regard to the arts?
Professor Nakash, we have about 30 seconds for an answer. Actually, less than that, 15 seconds.
It's too early to say, but there's nothing about Shia Islam that makes it less tolerant than Sunni Islam.
Mm-hmm. After this break, we'll continue our conversation about Iraq and its Shiite majority, and we'll take more of your calls at 800-989-8255. I'm John Itzty, sitting in for Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. In a few minutes, we'll turn our attention to the role, if any, for evangelical Christian aid groups in Iraq. But first, we'll finish our conversation about the Shiite community in Iraq. Our guests are Yitzhak Nakash, the author of The Shias of Iraq, and Gary Sick, acting director of the Middle East Institute at Columbia University. I wonder, gentlemen, do you think that the U.S. government needs to be concerned that Iraqi Shiites will set up an Iranian-style Islamic theocracy? First of all, Professor Nakash.
Yes. My impression is that right now we are still in a period of flux in Iraq. There is a power vacuum inside the country. Obviously, the religious groups are better organized than the secularists, then members of the middle class and the intelligentsia. It will take some time before the secularists can reconstitute themselves and offer an alternative. But let me say this. We live at a time in the Middle East where more and more people feel comfortable expressing their political identity in religious terms rather than secular terms. It is very possible that a new Iraq would be more religious than Ba'athi Iraq, which was very secular in large part because the government would not tolerate any degree of religious revivalism in the country. But let me say this. I think that there are ways to reduce the level of Islamic radicalism in Iraq. One way would be to form a representative government that reflects the various segments within the Shia community. Also, a government that brings Shiites, Sunnis, Kurds, and other social elements together. We would need to see some sort of a political arrangement, some sort of a mechanism of checks and balances. And the issue that we have to remember, 24 years after the Iranian Islamic Revolution, the large majority of Iraqi Shiites have not been swayed by it. Although the Iranian Revolution emboldened Arab Shiites, the Islamic Republic failed to reshape Arab Shiism in its own image. So my point is, we may see a degree of religious revivalism in Iraq, but I don't think that we are moving straightforward towards an Islamic Republic in Iraq.
Professor Sick, I want to get to your answer to that question, but first I want to go to a caller, Brandon in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Brandon, you're on the air. You have a question?
Yes, it was a question and a comment, sort of. I wanted to get your, feelings on it. I am a Muslim and by no way an expert at the religion, but Islam itself has democratic qualities. If you look throughout the history of Islam, many of the great leaders are more or less brought to power by the Muslim people.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel that instead of trying to fight a trend of a Islamic democracy, as it were, in Iraq, we should try to embrace it and perhaps channel it in the right way, because in doing so, I think we would alleviate a lot of problems that we end up fostering in the Middle East, and trying to get the people to support them in what they seem to want, which is a democratic society and a religious society, because in Islam the two are very closely related and they often are intertwined.
Well, let's ask.
That was it, and I wanted to get the comments from your guests.
Thank you, Brandon. Professor Sick, what do you think? Is there a possibility of true democratic Islamic government in Iraq, or do we have a sort of a theocracy that, while it might be elected, is not truly representative?
Well, this is, of course, the very big question. In 1991, the U.S. government was so frightened that they would end up with an Islamic Republic in Iraq after having defeated Saddam Hussein, that they basically backed away and let Saddam slaughter the people who were rising up against his rule, and particularly the people in the south, but also the Kurds in the north, and felt, in a sense, that the threat was so great that they were prepared to countenance a catastrophe, basically, to be able to let that survive. One of the answers to the danger, if there is a danger, of an Islamic takeover in Iraq is basically to turn to a general or to some strong man, perhaps with U.S. military backing, who would assert the control and order, all in the name of stability. If we do that, and it's perceived that the United States has replaced one dictator with another, I think it's going to be a much greater disaster than it would be to let Islam have a voice. Now, there are lots of Islams, and we've seen, and I think Professor Nakash was absolutely correct, that the people of Iraq have looked across the border at Iran and have seen what their Islamic revolution has done. And some of it, I think, they probably think is all right, and a lot of it, I think, they believe is a mistake, and especially in this glow of independence that they are now enjoying, the idea of having a group of clerics come in and repress the press, arrest journalists, put people in jail, and dominate the economy of the country, I think is something that wouldn't appeal to them. So the trick is to find Islamic leaders, an Islamic group, and a mechanism in which they can assert what is, in fact, a natural desire to have a country that expresses Islam or speaks in the values of Islam, but which is also tolerant and pluralistic and, in fact, protects the rights of minorities, even if they are not Muslim. That's going to be the hard part, and I don't think there's an easy solution for that.
Mm-hmm. At the beginning of...
I would, if I could, real quick,
sure.
I would, and I'll take my comment off the air. I would fully agree with the professor, and I think in this day and age, there is not a country in the world that has an Islamic state that it truly practices Islamic government, as it were, the correct way. And I think if the U.S., I believe fully, if the U.S. would help foster that in Iraq, we would end up with all the values and outcomes that we are looking for in Iraq. And
thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Brandon. I wonder if we could get a final word from each of you, gentlemen, Professor Nakash and Gary Sick. What can the U.S. do now to foster this? What can the U.S. do now to foster the best outcome? Professor Nakash.
Well, for me, the criteria for measuring U.S. success in Iraq, and I'm not going to measure it in days or months. For me, the criteria would be the extent of Iraq's economic recovery and the degree of stability and openness of the political system that would take shape in a post-Hussein Iraq. As far as I see things, it's important to move in the direction of trying to build a country that is politically stable, that has a decent government, a government that tolerates dissent, a government where you have people who are not afraid of expressing their opinion. If this government is going to be somewhat religious in its orientation, I would not be alarmed by it.
Professor Sick.
I think there's a tremendous tension in U.S. policy in Iraq. One is to basically have a democratic government there run by the Iraqis and for the Americans to get out as quickly as possible and thereby avoid all the dangers. The other tension is that that's probably not going to happen easily or by itself, and that the United States is also going to want not just a government that is democratic and tolerant, but a government that is pro-American and will, for instance, negotiate base rights with the United States. There's a huge gap between those two, and I think, if I understand it correctly, that even within the U.S. government, that tension has not been resolved, let alone on the ground in Iraq.
Thanks very much. That's all the time we have. Gary Sick, Acting Director of the Middle East Institute at Columbia University, and Itzhak Nakash, author of Shias of Iraq. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.